Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards was called by Martin Lloyd-Jones the Everest, the Mount Everest of church history. In that same quotation, Martin Lloyd-Jones said, "If John Calvin and Martin Luther are the Himalayas and the Puritans are the Alps, then Jonathan Edwards is Mount Everest." He continued that quote to say, "Jonathan Edwards appears to be the greatest Christian since the Apostle Paul." I would like to direct your attention to page 182 in your books, and the greatest Christian since the Apostle Paul, in the judgment of Martin Lloyd-Jones, whose judgment is worth listening to. In your books on page 182, you will see the beginnings of this amazing man's life. He's born in 1703. In your book, it says the 18th century was but 3 years old. That's such beautiful English, and you can just write 1703 there if you want to understand it clearly. In 1703, Jonathan Edwards begins his remarkable life. He's gifted intellectually so that at 13 years old, he's attending Yale University. How would you like to be attending university at 13? He was the 11th child of his father, Timothy Edwards, and he was the only son. Boys, how would you feel about having 10 sisters all older than you? Dads, how could you make that last boy manly when he's got 10 big sisters? And Jonathan Edwards was a brilliant man from his early times, but though his father was a pastor and his grandfather was the famous Stoddard, Pastor Stoddard, who was called the Pope of Northampton. That's a terrible thing to call a Protestant. But Jonathan Edwards' father, Timothy, said of his father, his father-in-law, the man's conversation was so lively from his reading in philosophy, history, and theology that it was always entertaining to be around him. That was the son-in-law speaking of the father-in-law. Wouldn't you like to be spoken of that way about the man who marries your daughter?
Yes.
Well, he comes from a godly heritage, Jonathan Edwards, and he goes to Yale University, studies for 2.5 years, and at 16, he earns his first degree from Yale. He stays on for another few more years and earns the master's degree, during which time, at 18 years old, he is appointed to his first pastorate. But he's a Congregationalist, and he's appointed to be a pastor at a Presbyterian church. There were no gasps there, so I'm wondering if you heard his age. He was 18. 18 years old when he's appointed to be pastor. He's been converted for a little over 12 months. 12 months of his conversion. And I'd like to read to you from Jonathan Edwards, from Ian Murray, who chronicles Edwards' conversion from his own from his own journals. Listen to what Edwards says at 17 years old when he was converted. He said there was a verse that led him to Christ. Listen to this surprising verse, 1 Timothy 1:17. "Now unto the King eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen." That verse led Jonathan Edwards to Christ. And here is the description of what happened in his soul when he read those words. And I would ask every one of us, as the sobriety of this event slowly settles down on our consciences, I would ask you, have you had faith like this? Does anyone in your church believe in Jesus like this? Here's what Jonathan Edwards said as a 17-year-old boy. "As I read these words, there came into my soul and was, as it were, diffused through all my soul, a sense of the glory of the divine being. A new sense, quite different from anything I ever experienced before." As I continue to read, I will sometimes update the English as I read. for ease. Never any words of Scripture seemed to me as these words. I thought with myself, how excellent must this being be? How happy would I be if only I might enjoy this God? From about that time, I began to have a new kind of thought of Christ, the work of redemption and the glorious way of salvation by Christ. I had an inward, sweet sense of the things of Christ. At times it came into my heart, and my soul was led away in pleasant views and contemplations of Christ on the cross. My mind was greatly engaged to spend my time in reading and meditating on Christ, on the beauty and excellency of his person, and the lovely way of salvation. The sense I had of divine things would often kindle in my heart a sweet burning, a burning in my soul that I could not express. Brothers and sisters, do you know that kind of faith? That's the kind of faith Thomas Goodwin spoke about when he said, what is it to believe? It is to see the excellency that is in Christ Jesus and to have the soul set a value on him that is beyond all other earthly treasures. It's the seeing and the setting. And Edwards saw it. Have you seen Christ in that way? I could wish that our whole congregation would hear this. I wish that the whole town would hear this and wake them up from their sleepy slumbers, thinking somehow they've had faith when they don't have that. Isaac shared with me that he passed around some flyers on What's Up. And he said some of them went back to his friends in Canada, and one went to a friend in Jamaica, and he sent me some of their responses, and some of them were angry because they said God should never be portrayed in the way this flyer portrayed him. And I would ask, have you ever had this kind of sweet sensation at the glory of God? Edwards goes on in that same journal entry. It's right there. And he says, in the past, thunder and lightning had been terrible to me. I used to be uncommonly terrified with thunder. But now they had become so sweet to me. Yes, this thunder and lightning. That now I would sit for hours in preparation for a thunderstorm. It rejoiced me, and I felt God, so to speak, at the first appearance of a thunderstorm. I would take such opportunities to fix myself on the majesty and awful voice of God in thunder. God's excellency, his wisdom, his purity and love seemed to me now in everything. I saw them in the sun, moon, stars, clouds, blue sky, grass, flowers, trees, water, and all nature. I used to fix my mind on these things and sit and view the moon for long periods of time. And in the day, I would sometimes give up hours to looking at the clouds and beholding the sweet glory of God in these things. He goes on to say, singing all the time. He would make up songs to sing because he was overwhelmed and said, no words can fit the glory that I'm feeling now. I've got to sing, even if it's a weak song. This was Edwards' conversion. And a year later, he became a pastor. As that pastor closed out, he was called at 26 years old to be a pastor with his grandfather. I had already mentioned him, the Pope of Northampton, Solomon Stoddard. It was his mother's father. And he goes to become the pastor there. Solomon Stoddard was a wise man and a good man. But his father was 86 years old, and he died 2 years into Edwards serving with his grandfather. So Jonathan Edwards begins 22 years of ministry as a pastor in the church at Northampton. And during those 22 years, he writes his famous books, and he preaches, and the great miracle came. The miracle for which he is most remembered, and that is when Jonathan Edwards was 30 years old, 4 years into his pastorate, the revival came. What is called in history the Great Awakening. It's in your book. Whitfield and Edwards are mentioned. In America in 1734, the Great Awakening came, and it was a revival from God. Edwards describes it. There's lengthy readings in your book on this. So I'd encourage you to read pages 182 and 183 and 84 for the sections that are included in there on the revival. When Edwards says, previously we would preach and there was a drowsiness, but suddenly there was an awakening all around. And he said, it began with five or six young people, one after another, who came to me saying, we want to be converted. And soon it was people from all over the town. That was the Great Revival. It happened for about 2 years' time when he was 30. And he says it was so many, in fact, that in the greater area around where he was in Massachusetts, but around that area, there were 50,000 people added to the churches. Amazing numbers. And this was done without advertisements. This was done without newspapers. This was done without special speakers. This was preaching. Edwards describes at length in his biography that he actually had to give a large portion of his Tuesdays to people who would come and just give their testimonies of how they were converted, or those who felt like they were falling into hell and needed some kind of assurance that they could be saved. What a glory to be a pastor and to give your days over to people coming to you. You're not picking up the hammer and the chisel to chip at that rock again. The rock is breaking apart and rolling down your doorstep. The fish are leaping out of the water into the boat. This is his experience in the Great Revival. The revival went away for about 6 years, and it came back again 6 years later. And when I say it came back again, I'm referring to John 3, verse 8. The Spirit will blow where he wishes. And he blew. He came down in power and blew on that time in history and sent a great revival for the second time in 1740 and onward. Edwards was the pastor there, and he was known for being a theological pastor. He was known for preaching heavy doctrinal sermons. And those grow from his active and constant mind. Edwards wrote some of the most important books in church history. And you need to know a few of these. Number one is called The Freedom of the Will. I mentioned this in our class on the book review of The Bondage of the Will. And if you've listened to that one, maybe you'll remember it. Martin Luther wrote a book, The Bondage of the Will. Follow the names and the authors. Martin Luther, Bondage of the Will. And then Jonathan Edwards wrote Freedom of the Will. And these two books, Lloyd, do you remember how those two books are related? Luther said the will is what? The will is bound up by its sin. And that was Martin Luther. What does he say? The will is bound up by its sin in his book, The Bondage of the Will. And then what does Edwards say in his book, The Freedom of the Will? Edwards says the will is completely free. Luther said it was what? It's bound. Edwards says the will is completely free to do whatever it wants. And it only wants what?
Sin.
So Edwards was saying the exact same doctrine as Luther, using different words to look at the exact same doctrine. Oh, you're 100% free. You can do anything you want. And the famous illustration is the lion and the salad. And I've used this over and over, even in this church history class. And that example is, if you give a lion salad or raw meat, what will it eat? And if you do that 1,000 times over, what will it choose? There's nothing binding the lion except his own heart. That lion's heart will never choose the salad. He'll always choose the raw meat. That's the argument in The Freedom of the Will. It is another one of his most famous books, Religious Affections. He wrote this book after the revivals, because many people were saying the revivals are fake. This is happening and it's not real. People are just getting excited and they want to be seen and they want a big show and they want entertainment. This is not real. And so Edwards says, I'm going to write a book called Religious Affections. And in that book, he attempts to describe the true results of saving faith. What kind of things happen in the heart of man when someone really believes? And he describes at length, very carefully, this is what's going to happen in the loves, in the heart passions, in the affections. This happens and not that. And if you see this, it's the false marks. And if you see that, you've got the true marks. Edwards was a brilliant preacher because he understood men are constantly deceiving themselves about the most important thing, and that is conversion. The goats will constantly act like they're sheep. That's one of Satan's greatest tactics. Richard Baxter saw it. John Bunyan saw it. All the great preachers through church history have seen it. Peter the Apostle in Acts chapter 2 saw it when he had to finger them and needle them with their sin. You with wicked hands have crucified him and slain him. And Jonathan Edwards does the same thing. If you have these marks, Edwards says, you're deceived. Don't think that that's sufficient. But if you have these marks, and the marks he listed are such that no goat could ever impersonate them successfully. Edwards wrote a number of books. Those are two of the most important. He also wrote a little document when he was 18 and 19 years old. And that document, written only 2 years after his conversion, is called The Resolutions of Jonathan Edwards. I have them here and I'll give them to you when we leave, but before I do, I'd like to read some of them to you. There was a time when my wife and I did not live in the village. We lived on a farm before we had our first child, and we would drive to Meshamba every Sunday. And on our drive for months, we would read these resolutions to each other. There are 70 of them, and they fit on the front and back of this paper. This is one page that I was able to put them on. I'd like to read a few of those resolutions. Remember, he wrote these at 18 and 19. And as I get ready to read these, I'll share something else with you. It was common in those days in America for people to write resolutions. Benjamin Franklin wrote 13. He was an unsaved, brilliant politician and statesman and printer in America and helped found the Democracy and Republic of America. But his 13 compare Aristotle and Jesus. Listen to some of the ones here for Jonathan Edwards. Most of them start with the word resolved. Resolved. Never to do any manner of thing, whether in soul or body, less or more, but what tends to the glory of God, nor be it, nor suffer it, if I can possibly avoid it. Resolved to live with all my might while I do live. Resolved never to lose one moment of time, but improve it the most profitable way I possibly can. Resolved never to do anything that I should be afraid to do if it were the last hour of my life. Resolved never to speak evil of anyone so that it shall tend to his dishonor, more or less, upon no account, except for some real good. Resolved to study the scriptures so steadily, constantly, and frequently that I may find and plainly perceive myself to grow in the knowledge of them. And on he goes, with 70 of these resolutions written as a young man. Now what I did today was I read them again, and I grouped them in categories. Can you guess the single category that is mentioned more, the single topic that's mentioned more than any others? Gossip is mentioned 3 times in 3 separate resolutions. As an 18 or 19-year-old boy, he mentions that he needs to avoid gossip. He's resolved not to gossip. Death, 4 different times, he's resolved to think about his death. 5 times, he is resolved to avoid sinful anger. 7 times, he is resolved to be kind. That really struck me. In fact, one of the longest ones is a string of synonyms for kindness. Resolved to be gentle, gracious, meek, forbearing. And he just lists these virtues. But the number one category that is mentioned more than any other in these resolutions, self-examination. I'm going to introspect. I'm going to look at myself. 14 times of the 70, 14 to the 70 resolutions deal explicitly, where he explicitly says, I am resolved to examine myself. I am resolved to check myself. I am resolved to look carefully at myself. Over and over, he says that he's going to do that. Twice he says he's resolved to check what kind of food he eats. And at the very beginning he says, I'm going to remember to look at these once a week. Gentlemen, what kind of man would be created from a man who resolves to do everything for the glory of God? Who looks carefully at every detail. At one point he says in here, I am resolved not to even let the least movement of my eye sin. What would happen if our children grew up with this kind of drive and resolution? This was a God-centered life. In the second half of this little booklet is another document that was printed hundreds of thousands of times over. In a village nearby, a church was without a pastor, and a young girl in her early teens, probably 13, 14, 15, wrote a letter to Pastor Edwards in the city next door. He wrote back a 9-page letter. When I say 9 pages, it's 9 pages typed on this size. Do you know how many pages that is handwritten out? In the midst of the Second Great Awakening, when he was writing some of his greatest theological books, when he was embroiled in controversy over Arminianism and some very conservative Reformed men who were saying, this is a fake revival. He gets a letter from a 14-year-old girl and says, let me just sit down and write a 20-page handwritten letter to her. He didn't know it would be published. It was published hundreds of thousands of times over. And it's here today. In that letter, he gives 19 points. The girl writes and says, how can I be certain that I've been converted? He gives 19 points, and they are full and rich and pastoral. And of those points, just listen to this. I counted them up as well. 8 of the 19 points urge the girl to be humble. 8 of the 19. Written to a young girl, not even in his church. But he knew that every soul ought to be won to Christ and led to Christ. And I did not count this as dealing with humility, but he does say on point number 8, he writes, it is the most difficult to root out, and it is the most hidden, secret, and deceitful of all lust. It often creeps in insensibly into the midst of religion and sometimes under the disguise of humility. What sin is he speaking about?
Pride.
And he writes that to a 14-year-old girl, or a young girl. Edwards was a godly, gifted, and dedicated man. He is the one who edited and published Brainerd's journals, as our brother mentioned a few weeks ago. And he served the Lord for 22 years at his church until, in one of the most remarkable turns in church history, after 22 years of serving, Jonathan Edwards became convinced that something his grandfather had done was unbiblical. His grandfather, following, I believe, a clear logical pattern from covenant theology, had been allowing people to take the Lord's table even if they had not had a clear testimony of conversion. And Solomon Stoddard allowed people to take the Lord's table if they simply came to the church, believing that by taking the Lord's table, you were receiving grace from God, and somehow this was a vital step to bring an unbeliever to Christ. Jonathan Edwards correctly saw that this was sin and unbiblical. And so he told his congregation that he felt he could not continue to offer the Lord's table, much as John Calvin did, fencing off the Lord's table from the libertines. But as he began to teach this, he saw that there was pushback in the church, and he wrote a letter to his friend and said, it seems as if this may result in my expulsion from the church. And sure enough, just a few years after, this man who was one of the chief preachers in the Great Awakening, one of the greatest minds America's ever produced, one of the greatest minds the church has ever produced, in the top 10 greatest Christians, Martin Lloyd-Jones says, the greatest Christian since the Apostle Paul is kicked out of his church. Remember that Luke 6 says, beware when all men speak well of you. And our Lord did promise that that you are blessed when men revile you and speak evil of you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my name's sake. And Paul, of course, Paul the Apostle said in 2 Timothy chapter 3 that all who live godly will suffer persecution. Men are fickle, and sinful men are fickle, so do not put your trust in men. Edwards is one of the giants of the church, a dedicated godly Christian. And in his last years after being kicked out of the church, and amazingly enough, though he was kicked out of the church, on his last sermon as pastor, from 2 Corinthians 1:14, he preached on them, "I'll see you again on the judgment day." And I wonder what kind of tone of voice he had when he said that. But he stayed around for months in the town. He already had offers to be pastor at other churches, but he stayed around because the church did not yet have another pastor, and they still asked him to preach and fill the pulpit. And he did. When he finished preaching at the in that church, he went to be a missionary to the Indians. And he gave up his great learning to go to 250 Indians who were at that time, most of them unable to read. He helped administrate a school. He helped many of them read until men from the previous church came in and disrupted it and broke the school up. And when the school broke up just then, the president of Princeton University died. It was his son-in-law, and they called Jonathan Edwards to be the pastor of Princeton University. He went there to Princeton. He was there for 5 weeks, and he died of a vaccination. He was getting a vaccination for smallpox, and he died 5 weeks after becoming the president of Princeton University. His wife, when she was able to get there, she took about 3 months before she was able to come. And his wife, when she arrived, I believe it was Esther. I believe that's his wife's name. When Esther arrived, she was overwhelmed because her daughter, what's that?
Sarah,
thank you, Sarah. Esther's the daughter, I believe. His daughter had passed away, and he had passed away, and his son-in-law had passed away, and then his wife, Sarah, saw that, wept over the funeral, and then took ill and died just a few months after that as well. These lives taken home early. Let me close with this. Jonathan Edwards was a great and godly man. He had 11 children himself. He was the 11th, and he had 11 children himself. And from those 11 children, he had 72 grandchildren. Someone did a study, and I don't know who, it's quoted in Marriage to a Difficult Man and then requoted in this little book that I'm reading, that from Edwards' heritage, he saw 300 pastors, missionaries, and theological professors. 120 college professors were from his children and grandchildren. 110 lawyers, more than 60 doctors, more than 60 authors of good books, 30 judges, 14 presidents of universities, numerous giants in American industry, 80 holders of major public office, 3 mayors of large cities, 3 governors of states, 3 U.S. senators, 1 chaplain of the U.S. Senate, 1 comptroller of the U.S. Treasury, 1 vice president of the United States of America. Those were some of the children who came within 250 years of his death. And I'm sorry, that would be 150. This study was done in the early 1900s. So within 150 years of his death, let us follow in the steps of the godly men that God has given us before us. To go before us. Mm-hmm.